Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Kristen and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 167 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell, and alongside me, Johnny Stufko.
What's up, everyone? What's up, Tristan? It's a pleasure to be here. 167 episodes in. Who are we talking to?
Yeah, man. We've got Dana Cavalier.
Yeah, Dana.
What a background, dude.
What a resume. What life experience. This guy's a World Series winner. He's worked with, dude, just the roster, if you guys go back to the New York Yankees.
Man, I had it written down.
Jeter, A-Rod, Mariano Rivera, Curtis Granderson, Sabathia. Andy Pettit, CC Sabathia.
Robinson Cano.
Robinson Cano with that MVP.
I love that guy.
When he won the MVP as a second baseman. Dude, also.
I used to like him a lot. Like, when they won, I used to have the shirts and stuff as well.
Remember the Home Run Derby? His dad was on it with him? You were a Robinson Cano guy.
I used to love him.
He's a big boy.
And A-Rod, too.
Those are the guys you cheered for, like, the superheroes.
Yeah.
You
know, I've got a couple of training shirts. Yeah. Number 13, Rodriguez on their back.
Dude, the pinstripes, man. It's like sports royalty in America is the New York Yankees, the World Series, the resume that they've had, the players, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio, Roger Maris, my favorite, Mickey Mantle, and then you have this new generation. You know, you had Don Mattingly in the 80s, in the 90s you had a young Jeter, and then the World Series that they won. And you got a 22-year-old kid named Dana Cavalier who gets the gig as a 22-year-old to oversee a $300 million empire.
It's interesting the way they've, you know, they haven't had a huge amount of success the last kind of 3 or 4 years, have they?
It's one of those things that comes in waves, right?
They went through a golden period, didn't they?
I just think, though, they're one of the most consistent winning franchises in any pro sports. And it starts at the top. They've had a really, really prominent, controversial, but consistent ownership, the Steinbrenners.
Yeah, they did.
Who was foreseeing that. But then you had a young Brian Cashman, who had success with Boston, who came in and, you know, did the hiring with Cavalier, and just the work, the life experience alone to work side by side, but also the results that the guy has, you know, he earned through the World Series, and we mentioned the Nolan Ryan Award, but
they've got a new kid in there, and his name slips my mind a little bit. I was watching SportsCenter the other night, and he's just hitting bombs everywhere.
Bombs, and he's young.
And his parents go to every game or something. It was really interesting.
Yeah, I'm kind of out. You know, baseball at one time was my whole life, and I would be able to rehearse these names and be able to regurgitate, but living in a different country. And
yeah, his name just slips me, but he looked like A-Rod, too.
Somebody's going to respond to
this
us.
This guy's like 21 years old or something.
Hitting monster bombs. This is, you know, back in the day we interviewed our boy Eric Cressy, who's, you know, synonymous with shoulder mobility and shoulder health and in the baseball realm. So baseball guys are different type of dudes. I tell you that all the time.
Well, it's interesting because they have different kind of demands, don't they? Like, for example,
for the body,
a pitcher, like the amount of stress they put on their shoulder and their, you know, their just the whole thing.
The elbow, the joints,
the wrist. It's quite amazing. They're like, they're not running, but they're still using a certain amount of juice on the actual field.
Yeah, an interesting thing is I grew up pitching, and my oldest sister, she was a better athlete than I ever was, Shauna, and she was a pitcher, female fast pitch. And the difference is the throwing motion for baseball overhand, coming over.
That or
it's over. No, it's over. Baseball. But
she was baseball, not a softballer.
Baseball itself, you're pitching overhand, and it's not a natural movement. So I would pitch 7-8 innings, and I would be required to rest 4 to 5 days before I was allowed to pitch again, just because the arm motion of throwing overhand is so stressful on the, you know, shoulder, the rotator cuff. But as a female pitching fast pitch, the underhand, the whipping motion is much more natural, and my sister could pitch back-to-back-to-back days.
Mm.
Pretty interesting, that alone in the
the whole league, but you can think that, you know, most teams when they travel, they're there for 3 or 4 games and they play consecutive days.
Dude.
And it only takes one pitcher and a different look, and the whole game is different. The
whole game's different, man.
It's like, so it's interesting.
I just read a crazy stat, a 9-inning game, an average 9-inning baseball game, airtime takes over 3.5 hours. Action time, 18 minutes.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. It's a game of patience, persistence, strategy.
I like it. I remember I went to this game in Washington.
DC.
It was the Nationals versus the Phillies.
What year?
That was in 2009. It was at the old stadium.
So before Bryce Harper.
Yeah, they ripped down the stadium because that was the last game at the stadium.
Hold up. Were the Nationals in the major leagues in 2009?
It wasn't 2009. It was 2007.
Were they? Yeah. Okay, because I know. All right, yeah.
Yeah, so they had this old stadium.
They were terrible then.
They ended up ripping it down.
Yeah.
And the Phillies, they had, who was that? They had this really. Dude,
the Phillies had two All Stars. Jimmy Rollins. Jimmy Rollins.
No,
the shortstop.
It was the batter.
Chase Utley. Chase Utley played second. Yeah, it
was Chase, and then there was one more.
You're taking me way back, but yeah, I know
he was hitting bombs that day too.
Yeah,
but it was just even in a team that wasn't winning, like the experience that the organization created, like all the different music that would go from innings to innings, the hot dogs that would come
out, the smells, the sounds. People
just it was just a really great event. You know, it felt like I was at a grand final here in Australia.
Beer here, $2 beer, peanuts in here, popcorn, peanuts, seventh inning stretch. How about the seventh inning stretch?
Yeah.
Take me out to
the wave. I like that.
The wave. It's so superstitious, the sport itself. Guys watching a baseball game, notice when the players are running from the dugout to take the field, they're not stepping on the third base line. If they're the visitors, they're going to be on the third base line. If they're the home team, they're on the first base line. But when they take the field, we don't step on the chalk. Mm. It's like superstitious. And then if you're in the playoffs and you're in a hitting streak or you've won three in a row, you're not going to wash your pants. Or you're going to grow a beard for the playoffs. And if something's working, you're going to stick with it. So it's very – you see guys with like the most
– I like that.
Yeah, Mike Hargrove was a famous World Series coaching manager, and he also played. And his nickname was the Human Rain Delay because Mike Hargrove would get as a batter when he played – he'd get in the batter's box, and as long as you have 1 foot in, 1 foot out of the batter's box, the pitcher wasn't allowed to throw. So the batter is controlling the game in that moment. But Hargrove would go like five brushes on his right leg, five on his left, unbuckle the left batting glove, snap it twice, unbuckle the right batting glove, snap it twice, hit the helmet once, touch the bat on the ground, home plate three, that sort of thing. And then he'd get in the – and all guys have their own sort of methodology of, you know, before they hit. The whole sport is like that. From the top down, it's crazy.
Nah, I love it.
Yeah.
All right, guys, before we get Dana on the show, just a big shout-out. Thank you for tuning in, also subscribing via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. If you do have an opportunity, best way to help us grow, two ways. Please log on to iTunes and just please leave us a five-star review. Second way, please tag us or any posts. Please share it with your family and friends. It just helps us reach more people, and all the different stories and, you know, advice from some of our great guests just get seen more.
Yeah, man, the reach is important. And also what we get to learn, too, a lot of the feedback just allows us to keep thinking differently and wanting to push more and more. So don't ever undervalue the impact you guys have on us, man. Tristan and I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. But without further ado, I introduce Dana Cavalier. All right, guys, our special guest is Dana Cavalier. Dana spent 12 years with the New York Yankees organization, with many of those as director of strength and conditioning, performance enhancement, and winning a World Series in 2009. 2009 also saw him win the MLB Nolan Ryan Award, which is a prestigious award given to the MLB's top strength coach by his actual peers. So we're very, you know, excited to get on Dana Cavalier. Dana, welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, bud.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Dana. Thanks for stopping by the show, sharing space with Tristan and I. We could get into the accolades, like Tristan aforementioned, the World Series, the awards. But could you share with our fans and maybe, you know, share some insights on what you're currently working on, you know, what you're doing in the strength and conditioning community, and maybe how 2017 shaping out for you?
Yeah, definitely. I have a couple training facilities here in the New York area. You know, one in which we service more of an athletic population. Another one where it's more of an adult wellness facility where we're servicing, you know, 40 and above, but also injured athletes. So two different brands that we're looking to scale as we go through the end of 17 here into 18. I originally built them as franchisable models. But I'm actually going to go a different direction, keep them corporate, and turn them into what I call injectable models, where, you know, we can put them into country clubs, hotels, resorts, and getting into more of the management side of things rather than actually trying to scale a consumer brand, which I've seen its difficulties in a very high competition market.
So these injectable models that you're working on, are these specific like practices and methodologies that you've created, these systems that like, yeah, and share some insights on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, in all my years, you know, working with the Yankees, I always say I was an asset manager. My job was to protect very high valued assets and oversee a payroll worth $300 million. So I had to really put together a lot of strong protocols in regards to assessment and evaluation and program design based on those assessments and evals in order to identify risk and which athletes were the highest risk, which were the lowest, and then protocols that match up to reducing those risk factors. So in doing so, I created and formulated my own training protocol that is heavily based on soft tissue correction and cleanup, mobility work, and in addition to creating standardized training protocols that work alongside the conditions that that person or that athlete may have. So we've taken that methodology and in one end scaled it to, again, that 40 and over population, which actually turned out to be a lot of our return to play protocols for injured athletes. But, you know, just based on 40-year-olds and 50 and 60-year-olds, they don't tend to have as much motion as we'd like, so we apply those protocols to them. And then on the sports end, we go the full gamut, everything from return to play, rehabilitation, and the full performance profile and protocols that we use. So they're two different brands, and they're meant for two different populations, but they all work off the same methodology.
Mm. Dana, you mentioned assessments before. Can we just briefly touch on, you know, the starting steps and when you either bring an athlete or a client into your facility and just exactly what you're looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, onboarding was always a really important part, whether you're dealing with staff or clients. But, you know, I created an assessment that was based on saying, you know, let's say, you know, I'm working with Justin Verlander, who's a pitcher with the Tigers, just recently traded to Houston. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get that player in. I don't really know much about him. What I do know is he's, you know, he's great on the field, but I don't know any of his limitations. So what I use is a heavy focus on goniometric measurement, finding internal external shoulder rotation, internal external hip rotation, you know, dorsiflexion of the ankle, and really start to cross-analyze my findings in terms of actual measurements and metrics with injury histories and just through conversation and dialogue with that person, along with, you know, postural analysis and assessment and movement screening, but not your typical FMS elements of that, but just watching them move through different patterns of motion and taking all that data in totality and analyzing it. So that's our initial assessment, but I was never one to underestimate the value of conversation either, you know what I mean, with the client.
Yeah.
Dana, I got to know, when you got the gig initially and you're in charge of that $300 million payroll with guys like A-Rod, Jeter, Teixeira, Granderson, you know, Mariano Rivera, you know, a guy like Brian Cashman, he has high standards. Did you have total free reins of the programming and of all of the sort of hands-on stuff that your services were hired to do with the Yankees?
Yeah, listen, I don't know how it happened, because when I first started, I was a 19-year-old intern. By 22, I was the head strength and conditioning coach of the Yankees. Wow. And they really trusted me. They turned over the keys and said, listen, this is your department. This is your program. Own it, because at the end of the day, you're going to crash and burn anyway. You know, so you might as well own it. And then they didn't really, and I say that only because pro sports has, you know, everyone has a tenure in pro sports, but yeah, you have to live and die by what you believe in and your core beliefs. And I always tip my cap to Brian Cashman and the rest of the medical staff there, because, man, they had my back 100% and let me run as fast as I wanted to run in a sport that is typically 5 to 10 years behind just, you know, just the nature of the game. So we were very progressive. We were one of the first teams to really introduce metrics and measurement to everything that we did. And, you know, customization and individualization was really the pillars of what I believed in. So it was cool.
Yeah,
right on.
Can't even imagine. Dana, at 22 years old, you know, Johnny mentioned a whole heap of superstars. These are veteran guys that are kind of in their early 30s to mid-30s. How did a 22-year-old get the respect of a 30-year-old to do exactly what, you know, you wanted them to do?
Yeah, so you know what? I always tell this story, but, you know, going back in time, literally before I got my opportunity as an intern in spring training, I was an intern at the University of South Florida, working with the football team there. And, you know, a week prior to actually joining the team, even as an intern, I was taking pictures through a chain link fence on my camera phone and sending it back to New York. So yeah. I was kind of like super fan transition to on-field coach within 1 week period. But, you know, as a 22-year-old, I think something that helped me was my intellectual curiosity. I had more cards and more strikes against me than I had in my favor. So taking that, I had nothing to lose, you know, so I was very naive, but I also knew that if I could learn just enough to live another day, that's what I did. So I became kind of the core specialist of the New York Yankees when I was 19, starting out as an intern. I literally would study as many core development protocols as I could, and I'd deliver them the next day and say, hey, guys, you want me to take you through core? And after that, I was completely lost. But that's how I started. I just started by being the core guy. And this was when, you know, this is going back to like 2001, when core training was like fatty. It was like, you know, a buzzword. And now it's obviously just, you know, adopted as a part of training protocols. But so that's how I started. I just got really good at one thing and I applied it. And then I learned more and more and more. And I really just took that approach all the way through. And, you know, I never stopped learning and applying new things. And guys appreciated the progressive nature, if you will, and the curiosity.
I'm glad you said you never stop learning. It's a sentiment that Tristan and I talk a lot about on the show. And my co-host has an awesome blog, which it's usually after these interviews where he writes about lessons we've learned, lessons you've learned through guests. And I'm really interested on, you know, maybe if you could share some insights on those huge figures that we keep talking about, the Jeters, the A-Rods, and when you're in your mid-20s and you're in charge of that Ferrari, could you maybe share some lessons you learned, maybe pick one of those guys, like maybe a story that, you know, in the locker room about one of these figures, like Granderson, maybe Teixeira, maybe Jeter?
Yeah, you know what? I always start off by saying these were the greatest guys in the world, and they get such an interesting rap because, you know, you're talking about everyone says, oh, huge ego, you know, they must have been difficult to work with. The greatest people that I've ever had the chance to work next to, they were classy, they were pros in every aspect, from the way they dressed, the way they treated people, from the guy that was at the bottom to the guy that was at the top, everybody was treated equally. So I always make that I always put that out there and let people know I had great people to work with. And, you know, the one thing I say that makes them the best is they were more consistent than anybody else. Through good times and bad, they never got too high and they never got too low. They always stayed nice and even. And at the same time, they found a way to be consistent every day. Derek Jeter, I could literally tell you, you know, where he would be at 6:41 on a game down a 7 o'clock game night. It was, you know, 6:30 he was here, 6:40 he was here. Peanut butter and jelly every single night before game. It was just so repetitive. And that's what makes these guys great, routine. And they live and die by their routine. And that really, for me, is what I had a chance to watch every single game. Mariano Rivera, every day, started the fifth inning, screaming my name, expecting me to be in the training room, standing next to the massage table so I can take him through his pregame, you know, trigger work and stretching. Just classic. A-Rod, same thing. Middle of the game, third inning, boom, got to stretch him. You know, Andy Pettit at every start, I had to have literally a thing of coconut water, two bananas, and waters ready to go. And I needed to be present in between every inning because his legs would cramp up and he would just want that mental support. So they were very quirky, but they were all consistent. And that's what I've learned. And now I work with a lot of high-end, you know, CEOs of publicly traded companies as well. Same behaviors. Amazing. And they don't miss. They don't miss. Mm.
Hey, Dana, so, how many people did you have working with you in the actual strength department?
Yeah, so at the big league level, it was just me. It was a one coach to 25 players. And some people said, man, that's crazy. But I got to tell you, I loved it. And here's why. When you are given the keys, you know, to that Ferrari and, you know, listen, it's all on you. If you have to perform in order to keep these guys performing. And the last thing that I actually wanted to do was have to worry about another coach screwing something up. You know what I mean? And I knew I could hold myself accountable and be accountable to myself. I couldn't say the same about other people. And I say that, number one, and I've gotten burned a few times when I actually even went and hired, you know, part-time coaches to help me at that level. It never really worked out. Everybody had their own agenda.
Yeah.
And for me, my name was on their agenda as well as mine. It got a little dicey at times. So I preferred to have a one-man ship. I created a hyper level of organization, and everything was a machine. And that's the way I ran it. Very tight, very operationally sound, objective focused and goal focused and individualized. But I did oversee the minor league staff as well, and I had tremendous minor league coordinators helping me do that. We had somebody at every affiliate, every minor league team had a strength coach. They reported to the minor league coordinator, and myself and the minor league coordinator worked very closely.
Dan, I always tell, I played baseball as a kid into my college years, and I always tell people of all the sports, the big three in America, football, basketball, and baseball. Baseball, the guys, I always say they're different type of guys. It's very superstitious. Everything from the lines of the field, not running on the chalk when you're taking infield, that sort of thing. And you said that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you said you talked about Pettit, you know, needing the coconut water and, you know, being stretched out. And those little idiosyncrasies, those consistencies is what got these guys to that level. Share some of those same consistencies with yourself at such a young age that you feel allowed you to get to that level so quick.
Yeah. You know what? I'm still an old school believer in a new school world of just work ethic. And for me, I knew that every day somebody was trying to take my job. So I had to be more organized, more detailed, more prepared, you know, than the next guy. I know it sounds so cliche. And it's like, yeah, okay. But no, what did you really do? And that was really it. And I tried to do the same thing really well every single day. And that was thinking two steps ahead. Much like any business owner and CEO would expect of their employees, I approached my department as if I was not only the CEO, but I was also the administrative assistant, and I was everything else at the same time. Now, obviously, every business book in the world would say, well, that's not smart. You want to delegate. You want to make sure your people are focused. But I wanted to own every single process, and I wanted to know everything that was going on. And in doing so, it forced me to be hyper-prepared in all aspects of what I did. So every day, I started to think about the players. Hey, you know, what do they need before they express that they need it? You know, what were some things that they were doing that I picked up on and saw where I can prepare for them and help their preparation? And that was really it. That and tremendous communication day to day, hour to hour, and sometimes, you know, on the half hour. How are you feeling? What's going on? What do you need? And they tell you, and I just delivered. And I became that guy, whether a player called me at midnight because he needed something dropped off at his room, or a guy needed, you know, compression shorts or compression, you know, on the plane, I had that ready and in my travel bag. So I was always trying to think 3 to 4 steps ahead. And I built my department on service. I wanted to service these guys like nobody else.
Dana, what was it like with your peers from other teams? Like, you know, in 2009, when I introduced you, you know, you got awarded the most prestigious strength award. And that's by your peers. So do you guys get out there much and interact with each other, share information at all?
Yeah, it was a pretty open forum. You know, everybody, every year at the winter meetings, you know, everybody, you know, gathers together and, you know, we share what's going on in the field as it relates to us and generally as well. And what each of us are doing, you know, to better our organization. Now you would think that's like, hey, why would you want to share that information with people you're competing with? But you know what I also know about the field of strength and conditioning is you have some people that they're very open-minded, but they also have their way. So you know it's great to hear what other people are doing, but you tend to still maybe take a little bit here, a little bit there, but you still have your core beliefs and core philosophies. So it was never hyper-competitive, which was cool. But if you ever needed anything, and you know, the Yankees-Red Sox rivalry was one of the biggest in sports, and, you know, we would actually train in the Red Sox clubhouse. You know, David Ortiz, Big Poppy was there, all these guys, and they had the Yankees. So And the great part for me was there was always an information exchange with guys like Mike Boyle, who was the strength coach for a little while, another guy by the name of Dave Page, excellent resource for me. And we just shared, you know, and it was cool. We were all in it together. And I will say this about the strength coaches in Major League Baseball is these are some of the hardest working guys, usually first ones there, last ones to leave, and just absolute grinders. And we work with every player, you know, so very well-respected position by the players especially. So, but 2009 was a great year. Anytime you could put some jewelry on your finger at the end of a season, it's nothing tops that, man.
What did you get, like a ring, or is that what you got?
Yeah. World Series ring,
oh, wow.
A lot of diamonds.
That's crazy.
And it's definitely a showstopper. And believe it or not, it spends more time in my underwear drawer than it does on my finger. I'll share that with you guys. Because I feel like I work a lot with my hands, and I'm like, man, if one of these diamonds pops out, you know, let me just keep it there. But I bought one from my father, and he wears it with great pride every single day.
Yeah, he should. I mean, you win a World Series, part of any team, you become immortalized. So that's an awesome achievement in itself. But Dana, we like using this platform to share stories of, you know, the path that led you to where you are now, and also lessons through adversity. And we were chatting with Evander Holyfield months back, and of all the things he kept talking about, he was bringing up this Cecil Collins. I don't know if you ever heard the story, but this young man when he was younger that beat him twice, that almost made Evander quit. And I was reading an article that you were quoted in about when your time with the Yankees came to an end. You didn't really have any resentment, but you felt like, you know, if they needed a scapegoat, you were fine with it when they let you go. Could you talk about when that moment happened and where you are right now, maybe some lessons learned and how you're a better coach for it?
Yeah, no, listen, I spent my youth, you know, dreaming about being a player for the New York Yankees. When I used to go to Yankee games with my father, we used to sit all the way in the upper deck. I mean, the guys on the field looked like ants. And, you know, my parents were both teachers and they definitely gave us as many opportunities as they could. But my dad would always say, listen, towards the end of the game, you know, we'll head down. And that was the closest I ever got to the field. So, you know, the fact that I got to touch the dirt, the fact that I got to sit on that field, travel around the country with guys like Jeter and A-Rod, I mean, it was like traveling with the Rolling Stones in your 20s. And it doesn't get better than that. But in doing that, I also realized that it's professional sports. It's the highest level of sport, the most competitive level, because of the money that's involved. There's also a big business that goes alongside that. And I knew that if Joe Torre, one of the greatest managers in baseball, was, you know, got let go, that my job could also end at any time, you know. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated the opportunity, and I appreciated every day that I was there, the struggle. But I also was reaching a point in my career where I was, you know, I did it for a long time. Although I was still young, I was ready to take on some new things. So, you know, when Cash called me into his office and we had a great conversation, he goes, Dana, listen, you know, we're going to go in a different direction, but that doesn't mean you did a bad job. That doesn't mean that, you know, in the future that I wouldn't be welcome back there. It has nothing to do with that. It's just the circumstances, you know, of what this animal known as pro sports is. So with that, you know, I had already been planning. I always knew that I should always have a backup. You know, I should always have a plan B in my life. And I did. You know, I had my training facilities. And when you put on that ring and you're in the greatest city in the world outside of Sydney, New York City. you're around some pretty powerful people and some pretty powerful, guys that are big time successes. So, you know, through all my networking, I knew guys that were owners of other teams. I ended up training them. So, listen, I'll tell you this. Whenever you whenever you are let go from something and you don't have the chance to let yourself go, it sucks. It's a kick in the ass. It hurts the ego a little bit, but makes you really look deep into yourself and say, okay, well, you know, I got a little comfortable with that, and because that was my job. Now what's next? You know, what do, but what do I want to do next? and what's called, what am I being called to do and what am I being pulled to do?
Hey, I just wanted to ask you a question about shelf life, because I interviewed, do you know what cricket is?
Yeah.
Okay, so I had an Australian cricket coach, and his name's John Buchanan, and he was Australian cricket coach for 9 years. And during that time, they won 3 World Cups, and his winning percentage as a coach is actually greater than guys like Vince Lombardi and Bill Belichick. That's how good
he's. How dare you? That's Are you comparing a cricket coach to Lombardi?
Well, no, I'm talking about his actual winning percentage, and what he actually did was greater, but they actually moved him on, saying that, and at the end of the day, when he reflected in hindsight, he started to believe that there was an actual shelf life in terms of how long you can actually stay in an organization.
Before, even if you're winning?
Yeah, even when you're winning. Wow. The effectiveness on the group and the culture that you bring. You know, you with all the experience that you've got, you got 12 years at one of the greatest sporting teams in the history of the world.
In any sport.
What's your opinion on kind of a shelf life of a coach in terms of both strength and just someone like, even like you spoke before about...
Torrey.
Yeah.
Joe Torrey.
Joe Torrey, and even... their current coach at the moment. So what's your opinion on that?
I look at, you know, if you can get to the 10-year marker, I mean, that's like being in a real job for like 30 years. Mm-hmm. So 10 years is a long time because, again, there's just, you know, every year you win, it actually, I feel like it adds another, it gives you another year. It's kind of like having more life and new life. But, there's no guarantees. It's a very high risk, you know, gig, you know, and you see it over and over again. Guys are constantly, you know, moving from state to state, city to city, and trying to, you know, find a place that they can call home for the next 5 years. Anything over, you know, 5 years is a job well done. And like I said, 10 years for me is wow. You know, you're a survivor. But you can look through pro sports. Even when I look at the, you know, the media guides, and you start to see even different strength coaches on every team, 3 years, 2 years, 5 years. Now, total career, a guy may be a professional strength and conditioning coach for 15 years or 20 years, but he's got 5 teams. You know what I mean? So, it's just the nature of the beast. And, you know, I mean, look at most, even players today. Players are with a team for a year or two, 3 years, maybe a 5-year deal. You know, the 10-year deal is like the golden contract in pro sports here, especially in baseball. Mm. And not many guys get it. And the guys that do, I mean, they're paid $200-300 million. And, you know, teams probably get 5 to 6 good years out of them. In the last 4 years, they roll the dice. But, you know.
Yeah, Dan, you're forever connected with, like, so our fans, our fan base from Australia, you know, maybe they're unaware, but like names like, you know, Ruth, DiMaggio, you know, Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, and then all the guys who played when you were coaching them. The Yankees are like a museum of baseball history and Americana. And, you know, focusing on just what you did with them, strength and conditioning coach. We've had a lot of guys on the show, like Buddy Morris, you know, legendary coach with the Arizona Cardinals. Joe DeFranco is one of our buddies, and we hear stories from them about it's only been the last few decades that strength and conditioning, and even having the title of a strength coach, has even been a thing. Back to the Yankees, one of my favorite stories was Mickey Mantle, and you know, the whole play, was it Jimmy? You know, when he was drunk during game 6 and he comes to the game, it's the 3rd inning and he's hungover. And by the 8th at Yankee Stadium, they put him in a Billy Martin. He did it on purpose.
Yeah.
Basically put Mickey in to embarrass him. And he takes this curveball and hits it like 500 feet over the fence in an old Yankee Stadium. And he gets to the home plate and he starts puking in the dugout. And
wow.
I wore number 7 from the time I was a kid because of Mantle. I was just had this fascination with the Yankees, that black and white era. You ever think back that those guys had strength and conditioning coaches? Mickey Mantle hit over 500 home runs, 536, was one of the greatest switch hitters of all time, abused his body, pretty sure had nobody telling him the do's and don'ts, the rights and wrongs of how to take care of the body. You know, how the sports evolved and, you know, just being a strength coach. Do you ever look back and like, man, what if we had this guy? Well, what numbers would they put up then?
Totally. But you know what I think about it? And this is scary. I probably shouldn't say this publicly, but I will anyway, because I like you guys.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah. But I was talking with a guy, Ichiro Suzuki, obviously, you know, Japanese player, one of the best ever again. And we got talking about training. And he said, you know, some of the worst years in his career came from when he was weight training. And his theory was, you know, when I was weight training heavily, my tendons were actually getting thicker and it was reducing the amount of motion I had in my joints. Right. Really interesting. So he said as soon as he stopped, you know, I guess American type weight training, and he started thinking about, you know, he had these machines that we brought in that were used for really like occupational type therapy in Japan that were full motion, et cetera. He started to become injury free, pain free, and his performance and just overall whip in his body started to increase. So the point that I'm trying to make is those guys back in the day by not weight training, I don't know. I maintain more of just the joint integrity and the function. Because later in my career, I started to spend more time, you know, working on soft tissue and releasing these guys because they were so tight and bound up. So this opens up a whole nother conversation for a sport like baseball, a power sport, you know, is weight training being overdone? And the actual like mobility based work and all that is that being, you know, underperformed, you know? So it's something to think about. Like I found that working hypertrophy with baseball players is not really the greatest thing.
No.
I moved away from it. I focused more on power and motion. And some people say, well, you know, if you're going to focus on power, you don't want too much motion, but we found our way. But it would be interesting to see how those guys would respond. But my question is, would it just be positive? Would he hit a 600-foot home run? Or would he actually start hitting 400-foot homers? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just a food for thought.
Sure.
But I know strength is often looked at as the gold standard. But in a game like baseball, especially at the pro level, I'm not so sure that it is most certain.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Yeah, you know, with the season being so long, what they play over 162 games, that's a huge amount. And when you consider how much time you spend on the road as well, what's your priorities in terms of trying? Is it more a recovery? Like during the season, is more to just recovery? Or do they get some periods of time we can actually just focus just on strength?
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, for us being the Yankees, we were in the playoffs every year. So, you know, October was a big month for us and September was a huge month. So my whole thought process was, you know, our general manager, Brian Cashman, you know, again, phenomenal job, would always build our team to win. So I knew, listen, the chances of us playing in October were very high. So I used to actually build our programs where, you know, the first three quarters plus of the season, it was keeping the guys fresh, focusing on recovery. You know, flushing them out, making sure they have the joint range of motion, you know, a lot of manual stretching and things like that. And we'd have some, you know, different, you know, micro cycles going on during those months. But really, when it came to September and October, I mean, that's when we really started lifting, you know, and lifting for strength and then transitioning into power. But in 2009, you know, in the World Series, which was like the last week of October, our guys were still lifting. So I just cycled everything through, but to go back to the original question, recovery, rest, you know, really working soft tissue and teaching guys how to care for their body. I mean, I had these guys, these superstars taking baths at night after the game, you know, salt baths with candles, you know, to chill out. And they used to look at me like, dude, are you kidding me? And then I'd throw some bath salts in their locker and they'd be like, hey, man, I kind of like that. Like, they wouldn't say it publicly, but they'd say, hey, you know, I kind of like that. You got a good – I mean, even this offseason, I was living in Laguna Beach with a player,
and you know, he's about to get married, and I bought best. He goes, "Oh, Dana, thanks so much." I said, "No, Sarah, those are for Phil, not you."
Yeah. Recovery's a
big. It's huge, man. Especially, you know, we play 2 and 30 in spring training, so that's 192.
Yeah, Dana, Tristan and I are both coaches.
You know, through the playoffs.
We're both coaches, and a lot of our clients are going to be corporate. Corporates, and the men are usually between over the age of 40. And you were mentioning one of your products, the target market is 40 plus. Are you working with the general population at 40 plus? And if you are, could you share some of the, you know, maybe systems and processes that you take place to ensure that that person over the age of 40 is going to keep getting better?
Yeah, for me, the typical person that I work with is the 40 and over CEO. Typically the corporate founder that is stressed to the gills because, you know, they're overseeing, you know, everything that's going on in their companies. And again, some of these guys are running publicly traded units as well. So they have high levels of stress. So when I first start working with them, again, I'll do the same assessment and eval I would do with our pro guys, you know, minus the, you know, performance stuff, you know, vert, long jump, sprinting based, you know, protocols and testing. But I always hit them with something really early. I say, guys, stress plus stress equals stress. That's my formula that I give all executives. And they say, what does that mean? I say, are you stressed? They say, yeah. I said, now what type of, you know, training are you doing? Because when I get these guys, their faces are hanging, they're tired, they look exhausted. And they're doing, you know, they're going out and they're pounding out mileage. You know, oh, I run 5 miles a day. I'm doing, you know, this class. I'm doing that class. All anaerobic, sprint-based, you know, pound yourself kind of stuff. I said, stress plus stress equals stress. That second stress is the exercise that you're doing. So you're trying to reduce your stress. That's actually putting more systematic stress, you know, on your entire system, or more total stress on your entire system. And they say, okay. So what I do is I start pulling them back. So before I start training them again, I take them through a lot of recovery, a lot of mobility, a lot of stretching, and just getting them to feel like, you know, feel relaxed, a little more slower durational type stuff, lower impact. And then I start to build them up again. So I have one CEO in particular, he owns a private aviation company, you know, overweight, had a cardiac episode at age 48, you know, just a wreck. Because he's trying to raise money and build this company. So I said, listen, give me 3 months to pull you back and get you really, you know, you may lay on my table and stretch and, you know, trigger work for 3 months. And then we're going to start to build you up. And that's what we did. And over that first year, you know, he's down 36 pounds. But it took a year. So 15 kids. I do work with that population, but it's, I use a little different philosophy than just, you know, run them hard and put them through the ringer.
Dana, can we talk a little bit about business now? Because, you know, last couple of days, I've been checking out your LinkedIn. I really like it, all the different articles that you're putting up. And you did mention that, you know, your niche is 40 to 60, that corporate type. So is that kind of an effective tool that you're kind of using right now to bring clients in, LinkedIn?
You know what? LinkedIn has opened up a nice conversation for me. You know, even before this call, I had a guy from Taiwan reach out to me and see if I wanted to fly out there and do a clinic for him. So it's been a nice tool for that. But the way I've approached social media is I don't like to solicit on social media. I use social media as a tool of giving. And I say, you know what? If I can give to enough people and give quality and not just, right, you know, reproduce content and garbage, people are going to be attracted to that. And they, you know, if they like your vibe, they'll become a part of your tribe. And that's the way I'm approaching it. I write every day. I put something up every day, but it's just, I try to put nice quality information. I'm not going to wow people. I'm not trying to hit home runs. I'm just trying to hit a single every day. And when I look at my work over the next 24, 36, and 48 months, that's what's going to bring in people towards me. It's not going to be, you know, one splash or one great offer to a landing page, to an email sequence that's going to do it for me. That's not my game. I, I'm not a tech guy in that way. And I just want to be an educator and a coach and a teacher. And hopefully enough people resonate with what I say. And they know that I have good intentions for them. And that's it, man. That's why I do what I do.
You know, having already that 2009 World Series ring in your underwear drawer that, you know, your pops won, how is it, you know, mentally since then and everything that you're doing now, do you put pressure on yourself? Do you have any sort of like, do you write things down for like your vision of where you want your brand to be? And is it tough not to compare past successes that you've had to where you are today?
Hardest thing in the world, man. Yeah. I'm type A to the gills. I got notebooks everywhere. I have like artist pads where I have like, you know, lines pointing to other, you know, circles and bubbles pointing and hooked by arrows. And this is what I'm going to do. Yeah. And you know what I did? And again, I just said, fuck it a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what? I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to go and I'm going to enter the universe, right? I'm going to just enter and I'm going to meet people. I'm going to shake hands. I'm going to network. And all of a sudden it's like, you're trying to plan your whole life and you can't. And, I never could have planned what happened to me as a 19-year-old guy, as a 22-year-old, you know, head guy. I didn't plan any of that. Yeah. All I did was say, you know what? I'm going to prepare myself for that. And that's what I did. And then I just got out there and I was aggressive in that I was excited to meet people. And I said, you know what? If I can take that same approach now, that's really what it's all about. And I think as a type A and someone that's an achiever, it's like that pressure that I know that I put on myself, it's like it's a cause of like extra stress and anxiety that and I can't perform with that. So why am I even doing it? And that's what I teach other people not to do. And you can't plan everything. There's some people are kind of like into this and others aren't, but every once in a while I'll pop on the Secret and I watch it not because of the production value, but I appreciate the message that if you think positive, if you're out and you actually believe that you can do these things, it'll just happen. And I know that sounds crazy. If you're out there, you have to do some work, but just give, man. Be a giver and people will see that and they'll feel your passion and they'll know that you're not full of shit and they want to be a part of that.
That's awesome.
The right people do. That's so it's hard though. I mean, I'm like everybody else. I had nice success young. And I learned from really great people, but the pressure that you could put on yourself to have a repeat, almost like a Michael Jordan moment with the repeat, is tough, but I'm going to do it in a different way, in a different space. And, I'll share this with you guys because it's been going through my head over the past, you know, years, like, hey, you know, do I just go back into baseball and work with another team or do I try to do it again with another sport? And I always go back to, you know, I was at lunch with A-Rod yesterday and now he's reinvented himself in the world of business. Mm-hmm. And is it about going back to something that you already know and are really comfortable with? Or is it about putting yourself out there in a new space and saying, you know what, I had success in sports already. You know, what can I do here in business? And then after I have success there, what can I do in this? And my ultimate, you know, goal is to just continue to not be a one trick pony continue to have success in everything that I do. And when I look at my life's work, hopefully when I'm, you know, 95, I can say, you know what, you covered a lot of ground. You built a great reputation and you helped a lot of people. And that's it. If I can do that and truly believe I gave it everything I had and put the work in, I'm good.
Dana, in terms of, I'm trying to phrase this question right. You know, in terms of leveraging what you've done, because what you've done is amazing to be with such a prestigious organization for so long. It's just top of the world. But how do you find that balance between leveraging off what you've done and then what you want to kind of do in the future, if you get what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get what you mean 100%. You know, a lot of people, like even when I opened my training facilities, they're like, dude, put your name on it, tell everyone you work with the Yankees and the place will be packed. You know what? It's not true. It doesn't work like that. It never will. I mean, even guys like Jeter, it doesn't work like that. It just, 'cause I've talked to them about it. It doesn't work like that. you really have to just continue to whatever you do, you got to realize like you're starting over again. So if I want to go and start a career as a motivational speaker, I can't go right to the big leagues of that world. You know, I have to be prepared to again, pay my dues, and I'll probably have to pay a few less dues just because of a reputation, but I still got to pay my dues. And that's something that I've had to get into my head and realize like, hey, you may be A+, you know, when it comes to training, you know, high level athletes and these types of people. But when it comes to the podcast world and the whole digital world, you're a nobody. And that's what I tell myself. You're a nobody. But now you got to go out there and you got to become somebody. And you're going to take those same skills and those same great qualities that you acquired in this world and bring that those characteristics with you as you begin to rebuild in the next thing that you do. And that's the way I look at it. But
rock on,
man. That's very well said. That's probably the best breakdown I've heard of someone that actually had a title before. That's fantastic.
For sure. Great insights, yeah. Dana. We appreciate you sharing that with us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I gained the insight just through personal reality checks, and you know, and again, it's funny because you talk to guys like Jeet and you talk to guys like Alex and all these players, and in a lot of ways, we're all in the same situations. Obviously, their bank accounts are a little bit bigger, a lot bigger, but you know, you would think that they'd automatically jump to the top, but it doesn't work like that. So together, it's kind of like we have our own little group of you know, support group. We're like, hey, what do you got going on? Yeah. And we help each other, and it's cool. So, but that's how I arrive at that.
All right, Dana, we're going to hit the personality questions of the interview now. Johnny's got the first question.
Yeah, Dana. So just for our listeners at home, maybe struggling with some adversity, what advice would you give them, you know, when you're having bad days, maybe some things that you implement in your own day to day when you're struggling with certain things?
Yeah, never make an important or a big decision. So that's something I've learned. You know, just the quest and the day-to-day warfare that goes on with entrepreneurship and building a business and building yourself. You're going to have days where you just feel like, you know, mentally you're shot, you're tired. I try not to make big decisions on those days. I try to wait till the next day when I'm feeling fresh and I'm less fragile, I guess, emotionally. And I make those decisions early the next day, and I feel much better that I didn't make a decision under fatigue.
Great advice. All right, Dana, next one. We're going to take you back to your childhood. What posters did you have on your bedroom wall growing up, man?
I had a poster of Cal Ripken Jr. that was given to me when I bought a TPX bat. Mm. And it said, what did it say? Oh, man, it said something along the lines of it was all about hard work. You got to put in the work. You got to have the desire to play forever. And that was kind of, I'm misquoting it, but it was along those lines. So I actually had some motivational stuff early in my childhood. It was like, you know, walking into the Robin's room. Yeah.
Cal Ripken was one of my favorites. Actually, I grew up collecting cards, and I have his rookie card when he came straight out of Maryland. But so, Dana, if three of your closest friends were sitting at a table and you weren't in the room with them, what sort of things would they be saying about you?
Obsessive. that would be probably the word. Doesn't stop, obsessive. And I just, you know, gets it in his head and just goes, you know, and that's really it. I just try to stay focused, and that's probably what they would say. And they'd probably say, God, is he going to call us again? He keeps calling. What does he want? Talk about the same stuff over and over again. I'm strategizing, guys.
All right, Dana, final question. You're going to be hosting a private dinner party. You've got 5 invites. Now, only rules, no family or friends, but it can be anyone, dead or alive. Who would you like to invite?
Who would I like to invite? You're going to say, wow, this is so, you know, cliche, but I would have a seat for Derek Jeter. I'd have a seat for Mariano Rivera, Andy Pettit, Jorge Posada, and my man A-Rod. And I say that because I miss being around all of those guys in the same room together, and the great conversation and just the interactions and the joking and the the chop busting slash ball breaking that would go on with that group. So that's it. I like I said, I love what I did. I was around some really awesome guys, and I'd like to put that back in the room with me.
Hey, man, this was really fun, and Tristan and I were really looking forward to, you know, you doing this with us, and we appreciate you taking the time and sharing some awesome stories and insights, Dana. This was really fun.
Yeah, guys, thanks for having me, and I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, before we let you leave, Dana, everyone get following Dana. He's www.danacavalea.com. That's spelled C-A-V-A-L-E-A. Instagram, he's at The Real Coach D. Nice little handle there. Facebook, Coach Dana Cavalea, and Twitter. It's nice and easy, Dana Cavalea. Well, as Johnny said, man, it's been an absolute pleasure. You know, it's some really great insights that you actually shared, and we appreciate you being so, you know, honest and open.
Yeah, definitely, man. You got to be honest and you got to be real and call it how you see it.
Johnny, my man, that was Dana Cavalea.
Yeah, man, he really impressed me.
Yeah, to be honest, before, remember what I was thinking before? Like, I've done a lot of research into Dana.
And like you always do.
It's one of those interesting facts. And, you know, it must be even hard for me. That's why I asked him about that leverage question at the end. It's, you know, you might even get pigeonholed for your whole career because you achieve so much so soon. It's that even when you're at friends, like, I've been out with friends before that have achieved a lot in sports. And they get introduced as the sportsman. Not as Johnny, for example.
Yeah.
When it's important that they've achieved something, it's not, sport just doesn't define them.
Yeah.
And that's what I was kind of hoping to get out of thing. And I think he did that really well. The fact that what he's achieved has been great, but I don't think that his time with the Yankees is going to define who Dana Cavalier is going to be in the future.
It's like the Orson Welles effect, you know, the guy who wrote War of the Worlds when he was in his early 20s, and then he did Citizen Kane, and then just never was able to do anything after that because he kept chasing that ghost, trying to, how do I live up to this? Macaulay Culkin. You see it time and time again. Not everybody could be a Michael Jackson who has that longevity and that consistency in a career. Some guys, it erodes their confidence, and you start seeing addiction patterns or behaviors pop up, and some guys are motivated by it. And Dana seems like one of these guys that's motivated by it. I liked hearing about, you know, him still researching and him understanding that that's just one phase of what he's going to accomplish and using that, yeah, as credibility, but also, like you said, not to defy. Think of, man, in America, guys, it's always like, what did you do in high school? Or like, I played high school football, and I had a friend who would carry around his high school football all-star tape.
Yeah.
In college. Think about that for a second. He would carry his highlight video. So think about how dangerous that is as people, if we connect ourselves to our past successes or even failures,
yeah,
in regards to moving on or developing.
I think it's really good. And I think Joe DeFranco does this very well, especially because he's got high-profile clients. And he will speak about Triple H and Stephanie when it's relevant to something he wants to get across. And I think the same as Dana, he was bringing up relevant Jeter, people, yeah, when it had something to do that someone could learn from, not from the fact that they were their coach, but the fact that this is what I learned from him and this is what I think you can learn from.
Yeah, like even though their bank accounts are different, where Jeter, A-Rod, and Dana are in their careers, which is true, they're all transitioning in a newer role and trying to figure out that equation of businessman, entrepreneur, figure, public figure. And he kind of painted a cool picture of like this underlying mastermind. And I'm sure they don't all get together collectively. Did I just say together twice? That was a glitch in the matrix. But going back what you said, he did use that applicably of, hey, I have a relationship with these guys. Mm. And it is common to have successes early. But as long as you talk about it and aware that you have to start over again. You have to grind all over again. The same work ethic,
yeah,
that got you to that point, mm-hmm, when you transition into another field, you've done this a few times, you can speak from experience, no one's going to give you anything for free. No,
you got to.
There are no
really
handouts.
Get your hands dirty and just those jobs that you think might be under you, you've got to do it. You've got to experience it. And
yeah, ego could be a killer, but it could also be a benefit, you know, a huge benefit depending on how you're wired.
Yeah, because how easily could it be that he could just put on the, like he spoke about, you know, he doesn't want to put on his wall that he was in New York, you know, like his friends suggested.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, yes, well, it's easy. Like, how many people would have done it?
Dude, man, I could relate on a very, very micro scale, but I remember when we had just finished interviewing Gary Vaynerchuk, and I was like, dude, we just interviewed Gary Vee. All I have to do now is do a blog about what I learned from Gary Vee, and it's going to be the one that gets shared 1,000 times. Mm. And it's like you learn real quick, and like Dana said, I don't care if you're Derek Jeter or A-Rod, that sort of doesn't work. You have to prove yourself in whatever industry or field you are in time and time again. It's not a one-trick pony sort of thing. One blog isn't going to get me to where I want to go. And the quicker you, everyone listening to this gets that, that it's a long-term sort of thing, I think that'll help us when we're facing adversity. Do I want to quit?
It's just not a one-off thing, man. If you do a great blog, follow it up with another great blog. And then if you do a blog every Wednesday, give them a blog every Wednesday, because people then start relying and wanting to consume. That's the way you build things, is consistency, as he spoke about. That was their major sort of point of difference, was that time and time again, they had that routine that went through every day, and they did it every single day. Consistent, consistent, consistent. It's one of those things that I think defines the ones that are successful and unsuccessful, is that consistency, that what they did in January 1st, they're still doing on December 31st, and they haven't lost a day. Do you know what I mean? They're just something every day or once a week that they consistently, continually pushing forward.
The powerful Tristan Cannell. And it's also what's worked for me recently is to stop expecting things. Mm. Like being expectant rather than being proactive about, well, I expect this to take off, or I expect, rather than the mindset of giving it and being consistent and committed because your interests are wanting to help people, not that, oh, they should read this or they should listen to our show.
It's about starting, isn't it? Like, yeah. I consumed a great video by Gary actually the other day, and he actually went back and he did clips from his first few, you know how he used to have that wine library?
Yeah, the wine.
And how bad he was on camera in episodes 1 to 100 or something. Mm. And how great he's actually got better looking with age, hasn't he?
I like Gary. I'm glad you brought him up. I like Gary right now, September 2017. This is my favorite version of him.
Absolutely. It even suits his persona, even the way he, like...
I think he's kind. Like, the thing about him is what's resonating me more, like, listening to his videos, because I find myself listening to some of his stuff, and he says he's not a motivational speaker, and he never wanted to be, but how honest, and you can tell he comes from a good heart. And in this day and age of, like, social media, and Dana touched base on not selling anything, but giving things away, it's just over-consumed with a pitch.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to sell, but Gary, I think, is figuring that out, that he doesn't have to. His message is more powerful if he could relate to the average man or the average woman and can relate there and then give them something. Look, I was there. Do this. Stay focused. It's not going to be easy.
Yeah,
people are going to tell you you suck. People are going to tell you you're shit.
But he just got started, man.
Just get started, man.
He just got started.
I still remember you and I in our old first podcast studio on a blank dry erase board with a marker, writing, figuring out what we were going to call this thing.
Exactly. And it's one of those things is, like, everyone's first episode gets listened to by a handful of people. But if you're consistently out there, people realize that you are for real and you want to help them in some way or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're consistent.
You want to make an impact. I think it was Steve Jobs. He said the first 100 drafts of everything are shit. The first 100 copies, the first 100 versions of anything – or shit.
I think people put too much emphasis on perfection.
Like babying something, kind of.
Yeah.
Just
out there.
And it probably would hold us back, because in terms of productivity.
Yeah.
If we baby something, that's interesting.
Analyze it once. You know everyone's going to have flaws and everyone's going to make mistakes. Work out what they are, and then the next one.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Try to improve a little bit more, and you'll be surprised. Like, for example, I listen. So, David Reynolds.
Race car.
Yeah, so he's going to come back on Talking to TK, because I want to talk to him about the season. Because his improvement this year has been incredible. He's in the top 10 now.
Yeah, we go back and forth on Insta.
But I was listening to, because I didn't want to ask him the same questions that me and you asked him. So I was going back, so I listened to it yesterday. It was actually a great interview. It's just
our one we did?
Yeah. The actual questions were fantastic. We just didn't know how to give him space or how to continue up, which we can do now, or even give each other space to be able to jump in for a couple of questions and then take a step off. Just little things that we do now without thinking about it. It wasn't natural to us back then because that was only like episode 20 or something. So we're talking about this could have been maybe
a year and a half
ago. Jesus. This could have been maybe February of 2016.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember where we were when we did it.
So it could be like a long, long time ago, but if we tried to be too perfect back then, it wouldn't be where it is right now.
Oh, for sure. If we were babying the process and not, I think something that you and I have done really well without talking about it is just trusting each other and trusting the process and understanding that as long as you and I both know we go into this with the same intent of helping people and wanting to share a story that people could use to help themselves, everything else will fall into play. And that's been our mindset collectively since jump. And I think that's why we're doing 166 plus episodes. It's because people need help.
Yeah.
And I'm nowhere near any – I don't know anything. The more we talk to these people, I don't know shit.
Yeah. I think it gives people opportunity, especially like in today's day and age, getting someone's time is like – it can be expensive, do you know what I mean? But yeah, this is a free way for people to get access to some really elite, you know, people in their fields. Do you know what I mean? Because I think everyone's elite in some way and somewhere. Do you know what I mean?
But you could be an elite housewife, man. You could be handling your shit at home, taking care of the kids while pops is out, you know, working. You could be elite doing whatever you choose to do.
Absolutely.
You got to buy into that. You got to sell out into it.
Unfortunately, today's day and age, especially in the Western world, you know, we rely, for example, just say me and you say don't eat McDonald's and A-Rod said eat McDonald's. People are going to eat McDonald's. Do you know what I mean? That's just the way it is with celebrityism and people think.
It's the hive effect.
Yeah.
It's like the collective machine and the people want to belong to something too. They want to subscribe to the newest. If somebody who has a high profile is doing it, we have the ketogenic, for example, keto. We have, juicing. We have cleanses, aloe vera. If it fits your macros, the list goes on and on. I think it's important to always go into anything with an open mind and try not to build walls around or limit your consciousness from thinking differently. And that goes on all across the board. It's not just with, you know, this sort of thing.
Yeah. Couldn't have said it better, man. Before we leave, Johnny, your social media channels.
Across the board, Johnny Stofko, guys, I appreciate you. Easy. How about you, TK?
Tristan Cannell, or Tristan Cannell Fitness across all the different social medias, or what's our vision boards? Vision board.
Vision board pod on Twitter, the Vision Board Podcast on Facebook. Go to our website, download some free ebooks. Man, there's some awesome content on there, man. We've been at this for going on 2 years in December, but we're just getting started.
For sure, guys. So check that out. If you've got any feedback, please send them through at info@visionboardpodcast.com. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to the show via iTunes and please leave us a 5-star review.
Tristan, you need to go take a nap.
I do. I'm pretty tired for some reason.
We've been at it for a while. You're hustling and grinding, baby. Guys, we appreciate you.
All right, brother.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.